First thing I want to do today is I want to set the date of the first exam. It's going to be a week from today, unless there's strenuous objections from anyone today.
I have an exam that day already. I know I don't bother anybody else.
You should be able to take two exams on a single day.
Right, that's the initial one. Nobody else is.
So my other classes, they agreed to a Friday exam, so I just soon do that today. I mean, yeah, if it's a real hardship, we can talk, but I just soon do it next Friday. And at any rate, what I would think though, for my exams, you basically should be able to do it or can't do it. You'll walk into the exam if you've simply done the homework assignments and you know how those flow. You should be able to do fine on the exam. It's not like you have to memorize extra material. I think just doing the problems is going to be your best preparation. So if it's a true hardship, we can talk, but we'll keep the exam on Friday. What I want to do today is, first of all, remind you that homework sets 4 and 5, I asked you to complete those by Monday, just so that that homework and calculation part we can have under our belt well before the exam in which you're tested on that.
I was setting out to do those this morning, and it says that they're due today at 11:30
They say to do, oh, that shouldn't have happened. On Canvas or on WebAssign, I'll look into that. But what I've been trying to do since we've had problem people turning in homework assignments late, if I've been giving the due date on WebAssign at the very end of the semester, and then posting on Canvas the sort of expected due dates for a homework assignment. The reason for doing that is that I previously had scheduled them on Canvas, and then people would want to turn their in a couple hours late. And so I try to reschedule it, and then it would either make a duplicate assignment. So now I have to keep track of multiple copies of assignment two, for example, or it did other funny stuff, like it wouldn't even show up once the due date has been passed. I wouldn't be allowed to change anything. So what I'm doing now is, so long as I remember correctly, I'm scheduling on WebAssign the due dates of the homework are all at the in finals week sometime. So if you miss out on a homework assignment, it's still worthwhile to go back and do it. You'll get full credit for the homework assignment, even if it's after the first exam. You can still get credit for doing homework assignment one. Because from my point of view, you're still learning something, and you'll get credit for that. But it does mean that the WebAssign due dates are going to be off. Okay, so I'll try to keep most of the course information on Canvas should be current. And then the auxiliary things, well, mostly just WebAssign. That all you have to visit the WebAssign website to actually access those problem sets, but don't pay any attention to the due dates. Unless you can't submit, then let me know and I'll look into
Yeah, I
it.
think if it's after the due date on WebAssign, it doesn't even let you like let me answer it. Unless you like request all answers and then you end up
Yeah, it used to be that I could make an assignment and someone turned it in after the due date. The only thing that happened is the file got tagged with late. But now they changed it so you can't submit after the due date. And so that's my clutch to get through that. Okay, other questions? Okay, so please have a look at the problem sets over the weekend, so that if there are issues, we can discuss those in class on Monday. Now, didn't devote as much time as needed to go over homework problems on Monday. Wednesday of next week, my intent is to actually give you a practice exam that will work out in class. And so you'll, and then I promise that on Friday, when you actually get the exam, it's going to look 90% exactly like the practice exam. What will change will be the numbers I use, et cetera, but the problem statements will be essentially the same. So you'll have, you won't have to guess what's going to be on the exam. You just have to be able to carry out the, do the problems. Okay, so what I want to do today, though, since I'm actually want to do some new material that won't be covered on the first exam, that the new material is going to be on subspaces. I'll do that probably the second half of today's lecture. What I want to do now, since we're sort of making a transition between material that's covered on the exam and material that will follow after the exam, is I want to give you a quick overview of what we know so far. And then what's going to happen after that first exam is we're going to get a little bit more theoretical. It may not seem so yet, but my emphasis up to this point has been on giving you calculational tools. And what's going to come in the sort of midsection of the course is how we apply those calculational tools to more general settings. All right, so let me first run through what we've covered so far. The most important thing and the most striking thing, at least from my point of view, that we do in this course is we introduce vectors in a way that's unfamiliar to most of you. Yeah, if you're coming from a STEM field, you're used to thinking of vectors as maybe physical quantities with a magnitude and direction. If you're coming from calculus, you think of, vectors as a way of talking about more than one variable. But in the context of linear algebra, at least the way I'm prioritizing things, we think of vectors as ordered lists of numbers. So, two reasons. One is it gives us a really concrete understanding of what a vector is. It's going to be a calculationable object because it's just a bunch of numbers. But it also, in the end, when we think of more general objects that behave like vectors, what we learn about how to calculate inside Rn is directly applicable even when we're thinking of vectors as being oscillations, or we think of vectors as being solution sets of differential equations. Our task in those sort of generalized vectors is always going to be to figure out some way of calculating, and that will be typically bringing whatever vector you have and representing it as an ordered list of numbers. So this basically calling vectors as ordered list of numbers is how we coordinatize vectors. All right, so and then the other thing I was emphasizing is these two operations that we perform on vectors. They're both, I want you to think of them sort of abstractly. They're easy operations. You add two vectors, you add them component by component. But you should also bear in mind that they're sort of abstract things as well. A vector addition is really a function that takes two vectors and produces a new vector. And scalar multiplication is a function that takes a number in a vector and produces a new vector. It's helpful to actually think about these operations in the abstract as well. And that will become clear today when we talk about subspaces. And then not only can we do these operations individually, we can combine them and create the typical way you create vectors in linear algebra is you scalar multiply and you add vectors together. For example, when we create a hyperplane, it's basically picking a point and then adding a bunch of directions to it. And then we also learned in that first week of class what the dot product was. That was important. First of all, without the dot product, we couldn't really carry out matrix multiplication. But it's also useful in getting geometric information from these really mundane ordered lists of numbers. If I know the dot product of two vectors, I can not only calculate the length of the individual vectors, the length of a vector is just the square root of the dot product of the vector with itself. But we can also detect angles between vectors because we have this geometric rule that A dot B is equal to the length of A times the length of B times the cosine of the angle between the two vectors. And with that geometric interpretation of the dot product, we're able to actually measure lengths and angles inside a higher dimensional space. All right, and then once we got this basic apparatus, this is all covered in the first week, we talked a little bit about the geometry of vector spaces. What kind of things can we make with vectors? And it turns out that although in real geometry, you think of more exotic things like spheres or toruses or parabolas or other shapes, in linear algebra, the shape of the geometric objects we consider are really pretty simple. You either have a point, a line, a plane, or a hyperplane. And nothing more exotic than that actually ever occurs in linear algebra. But in each of these items, whether you're point, line, or plane, they all will have a similar construction. You start with you get a collection of vectors where you have a starting point, and then the ability to stray from that starting point along a fixed set of directions. And then by varying these parameters, T1 through TK, you actually generate something that actually looks like a vector space. Let me just do a two-dimensional example. If I have a point sitting inside a space, well, this would be my P0. And then if I have a direction called, say, V1, then now the way I get the line that's associated with the point P0 in this direction V1 is I simply consider all the points I can make by setting x, say, a given point equal to P0 plus t times V1. And in fact, what that does is it creates all the points along the line. And these more general planes and hyperplanes are just a continuation of that idea. It's just that you have more than one direction from which you can depart from your starting point. But each of these guys, whether it's a line or a plane or a hyperplane, they still effectively look like a lot of vector space. Like you can think of this as a one-dimensional vector space sitting inside a larger vector space. Okay, so linear algebra is always concerned with, for the most part, the simplest possible objects you can work with. And in fact, our geometry is really just confined to these points, lines, planes, and hyperplanes. Now, let's see. One reason for introducing these hyperplanes is we had an immediate application as soon as I introduced these objects. I pointed out that if you have one equation in M unknowns, that its solution set is always a hyperplane. So it's part B here. I'm relating hyperplanes to solutions of equations. And in fact, the next thing we looked at was how to solve linear systems. This geometric picture from going from equations to a hyperplane, and I hope you're seeing this. Basically what I did, and go from passing from here to the second line, is I solved for this last variable using the equation, substituted that into the last slot, and then I expanded the resulting vector in terms of the parameters x1 through xm minus 1. So, going from equation to a hyperplane was pretty straightforward in that simple case. But more generally, when you have more than one equation, you're looking at hyperplanes and their intersections. If you have each equation would correspond to a hyperplane, and if you have multiple equations to have a common solution, they have to live on all the hyperplanes simultaneously. So your solution sets are intersections of hyperplanes. What may be not obvious, but nevertheless true, when you intersect hyperplanes, you get other hyperplanes. And so this family of geometric objects is nice. If you start off in this with sets of this form and you start taking intersections of them, you still have sets of that form. And so in that sense, hyperplanes are really sort of universal objects in linear algebra. All right, and then the next item, I guess, I introduced in the second week were the notion of matrices. These I also related to systems of equations. I said if you start off with a set of linear equations, you can associate with that a certain matrix. All you do is you grab the coefficients, the things that are multiplying the variables, you arrange them on one side of an augmented matrix, and you take the numbers on the right-hand side, and you get the column. The idea for making this transcription is because the way we learned how to solve linear systems was not by working with the equations directly. We found there was a really efficient way where if we simply write down the coefficients and the numbers on the right-hand side, we can manipulate this object until we got the corresponding equations of the solution. So we'll go through that in a second. But at this stage, I was just introducing matrices. And so I introduced them as rectangular arrangements of numbers with a fixed number of rows and a fixed number of columns. And then I told you how you can actually multiply matrices together. That relied on the dot product. And the way it works is you have to take the rows of the first factor and you take their dot product with the second factor and you let the index I run through all the rows of A, and you let the index J run through all the columns of B, then these are well defined, but only if this vector has the same dimension as that vector. You can't take the dot product of a three-dimensional vector with a four-dimensional vector. You have to pair similar components. So implicit in this definition is the condition that the number of columns of A, each row of A is going to have this number of entries in it, it's going to be the number of columns. So these row vectors are going to have as many entries as we have columns of A. And similarly, these column vectors are going to have as many entries as we have rows of A. And so for these dot products to be defined, you need the number of columns of the first factor to equal the number of rows of the second factor. But as long as that is true, these dot products are defined and you can compute all the entries of a matrix product A times B. All right, and then in addition to matrix multiplication, you can add matrices so long as they have the same dimension, so long as they have the same number of rows and columns, you just add them by combining similar entries in both terms. And you can scalar multiply matrices easily. The scalar multiple of a vector of a matrix by 2 is the matrix you get by multiplying each entry of the original matrix by 2. And finally, we had a last operation of the transpose of a matrix. That's simply when you convert rows into columns. All right, and so there's a summary of what we learned about matrices. Our first application was to solve linear systems. So the way we did this is I first spent a lecture telling you how to solve systems of equations by a method other than the substitution method. Substitution method is what you learn in high school. You pick a variable in one equation, you use that equation to eliminate it, you substitute the result into subsequent equations to eliminate more variables until you work your way through the equations and you don't have any more variables you can replace. Whatever variables remain are the free variables in your solution. So that's sort of high school algebra. But it's when you have a large system of equations, it's really tedious because you constantly have to substitute into subsequent equations, which are going to make it prone to making little arithmetic errors or not copying one line down correctly into another line. That way of solving system of equations is not very efficient and it's really error prone. So instead, what I developed then was a way of taking the set of equations corresponding to a linear system and systematically manipulating the equations rather than the variables until we transform the equations into the equations of the solution. I showed you how you could do that. There are things you can do to equations that don't change the solution. You change the order of the equation, doesn't change the solution. If you multiply an equation by a non-zero number, it doesn't change the solution of the equation. Well, there's things we can do to equations that I showed you. You can actually systematically go from an arbitrary set of equations to a set of equations that models the best presentation of the solution. And then, having established that, what we did is to say, well, that's the idea we're going to work with. We're going to systematically transform the original linear system into its solution. Instead of operating directly on equations, we simplified it by replacing equations by their augmented matrices. And then the things we could do to equations that don't change the solution, we can implement them on the augmented matrices. Then each of these operations, whether I interchange two rows, that just corresponds to changing the order of the equations that correspond to the rows. Replacing a row by a scalar multiple, that's equivalent to changing an equation by multiplying it by a non-zero number. And here this elementary row operation corresponds to replacing an equation in your set by its sum with a multiple of another equation. If I pull these operations back to the level of equations, they don't change the solution set. But what's nice about these operations is that they can be implemented really rapidly on an augmented matrix. So the idea for solving linear systems is to convert your equations into augmented matrices, use elementary row operations until you get the augmented matrix of the solution. Question remains is, well, how do I get to the augmented matrix of the solution using elementary row operation? And for that, you need to know what the solution should look like. The first thing I introduced was row echelon form. A matrix in row echelon form, it's not necessarily going to be the augmented matrix of the solution, but it's the first destination you have as you try to find that augmented matrix. You want to get it in a form where the pivots being the first non-zero entries of the matrix. So in this slide, I've underlined what should be the pivots of this matrix. You want them to occur in a downward staircase. So that will mean sometimes you have to interchange rows to get pivots up in this upper left-hand corner. But most of the time, you're going to be doing this operation. You're going to use upper rows to clear out entries below pivots. You pick a factor up here, or you pick a, if you had a non-zero entry here, you would try to figure out what number do I multiply this vector times so that that leading component exactly cancels. But that's only the first stage of getting to the augmented matrix of the solution. What you eventually want to do is get the matrix in reduced row echelon form. And that's going to be a form where, in fact, once you get the row echelon form, the position of the pivots within the matrix is not going to change. So I'll have a pivot here, 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 and notice in this one, my pivots are all sitting in the same spot. The way you pass from the row echelon form to the reduced row echelon form is, first of all, you use this operation. So if this was a number two, I'd have to divide the whole row by two in order to get that leading term one. So you have to rescale all the pivots so that they're equal to one. And then you use this third operation to clear out the entries that sit above pivots. Now, you could still have columns here that have non-zero numbers, and that would be okay for a matrix in reduced row echelon form. What's essential, and you always concentrate on, what's happening with the pivots. In row echelon form, the pivots occur in a downward staircase. In reduced row echelon form, the pivots are going to occur in a downward staircase, but they're also going to all equal one, and above and below pivots, I only have zeros. In columns that don't have pivots, well, they have to be distributed in such a way that they don't become pivots, but they're allowed to be non-zero. So for example, this second column, as I've written it here, would not contain a pivot, but there could be a non-zero number in that column. All right, so the point of the matrix in reduced row echelon form is that that's the thing we interpret as the augmented matrix of the solution. So here's the full scheme. To solve a linear system, the first thing you do is you write down the augmented matrix that corresponds to that. Then you row reduce to row echelon form, because that's in that part of the process, you basically start off in the upper left-hand corner, clear out entries below that pivot in the first row, and then you move to down and over to the right, and you work with a submatrix and try to clear out entries below the pivot in the second row. And then you move to the third row and try to eliminate entries there. And you'll steadily move across the matrix from the upper left to the lower right. When you get to the bottom row, then you're in row echelon form. After that, your strategy changes. You've gotten the matrix in this form, then you have to make all the pivots equal to one, and you also have to clear out the entries that are sitting above pivots. So in the second stage, once you've renormalized the pivot so they're all equal to one, the idea is to add the lower rows to clear out entries above the pivots. So the first thing I would do in this example here is I would focus on this guy. If this was two, I would multiply the whole row by two to get that pivot equal to one. And then I would use that one, I would add this multiples of this bottom row to clear out the entries above this pivot. On this side, I have nothing but zero. So adding multiples of the bottom row to upper rows is not going to affect anything on this side of the matrix, but directly above that pivot, I can get the cancellations. And so you do that. It's a systematic process that you eventually can take any matrix into a unique matrix in reduced row echelon form. All right, now that's the tedious part of the calculation. What remains to solve the linear system is to write down the solution that you found. So that's done in a couple steps. First of all, you need to decide which variables you want to interpret as free variables and which variables you want to interpret as fixed. Anytime I solve an equation, whether it's x plus y is equal to 5, I have two variables in one equation. So if I don't have any other equations, this may be an equation, but what's helpful to understand it is to write this as maybe 5 minus y. So it tells me at least the first variable, the equation tells me that the first variable is already determined once I know the second variable. And in this instance, I would interpret this as a fixed variable. And the y on the right-hand side of the equation is going to be the free variable in the solution. And so what the matrix in reduced row echelon form does for you, it allows you to make a choice. Here, it's sort of a natural. I just chose x to be the fixed variable, and I chose y to be the free variable as soon as I write down this equation. But implicit in the reduced row echelon form is a consistent way of identifying free variables and fixed variables. Basically, you'll interpret the columns of the row echelon form or the reduced row echelon form, the ones that have pivots. Let's give an example here. 1, 0, 0, 1, 2, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. So here's an example of the matrix. Let's make it an augmented matrix, and then to each column on this left-hand side, we have attached naturally certain variables. First variable, first column, second variable, second column, etc. What we do once we reach row echelon form is we figure out what the pivots live, and then we decide that when I write down the equations, I'm going to interpret x1 and x3 as my fixed variables, and the variables that correspond to columns that don't contain pivots. So I'm underlying the pivots here. So you see that that fourth column doesn't have a pivot, nor does the second column. So you use the form of the matrix in reducible echelon form to decide which variables are going to be fixed and which variables are going to be free. And then you write down the equations, but you will move the free variables over to the right-hand side of the equations. So for example, that first equation tells me that 1 times x1 plus 0 times x2 plus 0 times x3 plus 1 times x4 is equal to 2, or simply x1 plus x4 is equal to 2. All right, so here's an equation. It's supposed to be the equation of the solution. What are the free variables and what are the fixed variables? Here's your fixed variable. And so what I can do is I'll use this equation to write x1 is equal to 2 minus x4. Now I have the free variable expressed, sorry, the fixed variable expressed in terms of the free variables. So this reducible echelon form is going to, you just read off the equations, but you're also going to interpret the variables. If you have a free variable, you also want to move it over to the right-hand side of the equation. And it'll typically pick up a minus sign as you move it to the other side. All right, and then once you've got the free variables expressed in terms, the fixed variables expressed in terms of the free variables, then you write down a solution vector. Let's see if I can do that. Let me stick to this example. So this first row told me that x1 is equal to 2 minus x4. The second row is going to, here's my fixed variable. So x3 is going to equal 1. Now here's, this column corresponds to a free variable. I'm going to take it to the opposite side of the equation. So I'll reverse the sign, and then I'll have x4. All right. So from this augmented matrix, I get equations that express the fixed variables in terms of the free variables. What remains to see the solution as a hyperplane is to substitute where I can for the free fixed variables. X2, X3 is equal to 1 minus X4 and X4. All right. You write down all the components of a solution vector using the equations that you have for the fixed variables. And then the last step is to expand this vector solution in terms of the free variables. So here we have 2, 0, 1, 0. This first vector, I'm just picking off the constant terms in each component. Then I'm going to have terms in the components that are proportional to, say, x2. Put that outside, and the only place x2 occurs is in the second component. So you have that. And then the x4, that free variable occurs in three different slots. Minus 1, 0, minus 1, and 1. And now I've got the solution vector expressed as points on a hyperplane. Here's your starting point, p0. Here's some parameter times a fixed vector. I'll write it t1 plus times v1, and then some other parameter, we'll call it t2, v2. So your solution vectors basically have the form of a point on a hyperplane. Okay, so that process, it's a long scheme, but you should be able to follow this and solve any linear system to do well on the exam. Okay, let's see. Then the last topic we've covered, in fact, we just did it, finished it on Monday, or I guess just on Wednesday, was the inverses of matrices. Matrix inverses are just like multiplicative inverses. If you have two matrices, A such that A times B is equal to the identity matrix, then A is the inverse of B the minus first, and B is also the inverse of A. So, the point of the lectures on inverses was actually how to calculate, given a matrix A, how to actually find its inverse. So we did that in a roundabout way. I introduce elementary matrices as a theoretical idea. What they allow me to do is implement elementary row operations by matrix multiplication instead of acting directly on it. The reason for doing so is that if I can row reduce a matrix to the identity matrix, then that row reduction process could be represented as a product of elementary matrices. And that allowed me to identify what the inverse of B would be. If I have the product of elementary matrices, it hits the matrix B and I get thin, then I know that product had to be the inverse. And then what we did is we found an efficient way of actually getting that product without having to compute the individual elementary matrices. So that led to the following algorithm. What you do is you start to find the inverse of a matrix A. You form this augmented matrix, but now instead of augmenting the matrix A by a single vector, you're augmenting it by the identity matrix of the same size as A. And then you apply elementary row operations until you reach reduced row echelon form. Now, in this instance, we're not solving linear equations. We're trying to find the inverse of a matrix. But the calculational procedure we perform is exactly the same one we use to solve equations. We row reduce first to row echelon form and then to reduced row echelon form. We'll get a unique matrix as a result. Then what you do is you look at this reduced row echelon form. It's going to be of one of two forms. So this matrix A adjoined with I, it's either going to go to something where A has been transformed to the identity matrix, and here we get something else. I'll just call it I double prime. Or we get the some other matrix on the right hand, left hand side. I'll call that A double prime, and I'll stipulate in this on this arrow A double prime does not equal the identity matrix. Then you're going to get something else here. But the point in this latter circumstance is that if this right hand, left hand side does not row reduce to the identity matrix, no matter what you get here, it means that A is not invertible. So if you get something like this, where this left hand side is not equal to the identity matrix, your conclusion is there's no inverse. And that's the calculation. It's a simple row reduction. As soon as you get this matrix and transform it into its reduced echelon form, you know immediately what its inverse is. If the left-hand side is the identity, the right-hand side is going to be the inverse. If the left-hand side is not the identity, then the matrix has no inverse. All right, and then the last thing we did on Wednesday, I guess, was I talked about the fundamental theorem of matrix inverses. This is actually the departure point for what's going to go on after the first exam. Here we're getting a little bit more theoretical. This theorem is not about calculations, but it's about relating different calculations. So a matrix, if it has an inverse, then there's four other things that are immediately consequences of A having an inverse. And they're all equivalent to one another. If I know if any one of the following five statements is true, then all the others are also true. So if I have an inverse, then I know if I make a linear system using A as a coefficient matrix, I always have a unique solution. There can be no free parameters. Also, if I have what's called a homogeneous linear system where the right-hand side is zero, then in fact, the only solution, if A has an inverse, the only solution of this equation is going to be the trivial one where X is the zero vector. Then another consequence is that if A has an inverse, then A has to be row reducible to the identity matrix. In fact, when I take the matrix A and I can find its unique reducible echelon form, it has to be identical to the identity matrix. And then finally, here's a theoretical consequence of A having the inverse. It means A can always be factorized in terms of elementary matrices. And each of these statements, hopefully they look different enough to see that there's actually some meat to this theorem. But the way we actually proved it is we simply used our familiarity with the calculations by which each of these things is confirmed, and we saw, oh yeah, they are related. For example, A having an inverse, well, it's directly related to A being row reducible to the identity matrix because of this calculation. But what we're going to see in the future, immediately after the first exam, is that we'll have diverse calculations that we can anyway connect together by virtue of sort of under the hood, you can see these connections, but as stated as a theorem, the connections are not so obvious. Okay, so that's the material that is going to be covered on the first exam. If you want a better idea of what's going to be precisely on the exam, you should look at Canvas. I've got some old exam posted. And in fact, what we'll do on Wednesdays, I'm going to pick one of my practice exams, and I'm going to go through it in class. I'll show you how to calculate the various problems, how to do that efficiently. And then you should be well prepared for the exam on Friday. But in the meantime, I want to make a little bit more progress in the course. So I'm going to spend the last 7 minutes of today's lecture introducing a topic called subspaces that we'll talk about more on Monday. So again, linear algebra is based on a set of vectors under which you have two fundamental operations, scalar multiplication and vector addition. And basically all we do with vectors is we take linear combinations of them for some effect. So one example of this is so-called span of a set of vectors. If I have a given list of vectors, v1 through vk, all living in the same vector space, I can scalar multiply them and add them together. And in fact, by varying these coefficients, c1 through ck, letting them vary over the entire real line, I'm going to create a hyperplane. Well, it's a special hyperplane, though. You notice that the span of vectors, the set of all possible linear combinations of them, is a particular example of a hyperplane. It's one where the starting point actually is the zero vector. So if you think of I start with a given list of vectors, v1 through vk, then I create the span of those vectors. I do that by considering every vector I can reach by taking linear combinations of those k vectors. And here, I'll put a line here and remind you that the idea is to let these numbers c1 through ck vary over the entire real line. All right, now that set is actually a hyperplane because you can also write it as the zero vector plus c1 v1 plus dot 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 plus ck vk. And again, same letting these coefficients vary. Dot dot ck ranging over r. It's a special case of a hyperplane. It's where the hyperplane actually passes through the origin. And so your starting point is not an arbitrary point in whatever space these vectors are living in. Rather, your starting point has to be the origin. All right, now this set of vectors is a special case of a hyperplane that contains the origin. And these are going to be the kind of subsets that are most interest in linear algebra. They're just as hyperplanes can be thought of as solution sets of linear systems, so can these hyperplanes, but they're going to be linear systems of a very special type. What's going to happen is that the solution set of AX equals B, we've already seen that this is a hyperplane. But the solution set of a linear system where the right-hand side is the zero vector is all going to be the span of a certain set of vectors, V1 through VK. So these spans of vectors are, they still correspond to solution sets of equations, but they're what we call homogeneous linear systems, where the vector on the right-hand side is not a non-zero vector, rather it's equal to the zero vector. We got 3 minutes left. So another way of thinking about these spans of vectors and how they're distinguished from a more general hyperplane is that a span of vectors, it's always a hyperplane, but necessarily it has to pass through the origin as well. So if you think in terms of a line, here's a line, but thinking of it as a one-dimensional subset of this plane here, it's not going to be a span because this line does not pass through the origin. But this one would be a span of vectors. In fact, you can see what it is. You start with a vector heading in the direction of that line, and then you add multiples of itself to itself, and you just fill out this line. For these lines that are offset from the origin, what's going to happen with them is that if you take two vectors on this line and you add them together, you stay on the line. But if you take two vectors on this line and you add them together, it moves you off the line. And that's the phenomenon we're going to be concentrating on Monday. Now, to be a real vector space, you need more than it to just look like a vector space. This looks like a line, a one-dimensional vector space. Well, that's true. It looks like that. But vector spaces, as we deal with them in linear algebra, are also subject to scalar multiplication and vector addition. So I can't regard this line as a vector space because as soon as I add two vectors that live in that line together, I get taken off the line. You can see that really quickly in this example. If I add this vector to this vector, they both live on that line, but the rule for adding these vectors geometrically would be to transport this guy, place it at a tip, and now you see that the sum of this vector and that vector is actually a point out here that's off the line. That wouldn't happen for this set of vectors. If I add two vectors that live on this line, I add them together, I just stay on that line. Okay. So that's the phenomenon we'll be talking about on Monday, okay? All right, so over the weekend, do homework sets problems 4 and 5. If we have any issues there, we'll straighten them out on Monday. And then Wednesday of next week, we'll do a review session for the exam. Yeah.
So will you change the due date on them? Because right now you can't.
I'm going to go back to my office and change that. Yeah, I'm sure. Yep. Have a good weekend.
Have a good weekend.
Yep, you too.